We have Candace Platter in studio today. She's been on the show before. Welcome, Candace. Hello.
Hello.
And we are going to just briefly talk about resolutions versus intention and in addiction during New Year's Eve. So tell us, you know, what is the difference
between an intention and a resolution?
Yes.
Yeah. For me, I guess I could put it, I'll try to put it as briefly as I can, but a resolution is something that comes from the outside in. It's what society tells us we're supposed to be doing, like I should quit smoking, or I should, you know, lose some weight, or I should clean up my basement, whatever it is. And so because people are making resolutions all the time at New Year's, that's what everybody's talking about. You kind of have to have one, you know, but it may not be something that you really want to be doing. It's that somebody's telling you you should be doing. Somehow you're getting that message from the outside. An intention is a different thing. An intention is about how you want to feel about yourself, how you want to show up in the world, what you stand for, you know, what your values are, and how you feel from the inside out. And, I mean, I can give you an example from my own life, if you like.
Sure.
I like what you say about couching. I really like that as a verb, because I'm quite a couch potato by nature, and I'd rather sit down instead of exercise. I'll sit down until the urge passes, you know. But I know that I have to move. I know that I have to do that. So I've been thinking every year that I really need to get more exercise. I really need to go to the gym more. I do belong to a gym. I don't go very often. You know, it's that kind of feeling. This year, I'm feeling really differently about it. This year, I'm feeling like I want to get as fit as I can get this year. I want to do it for me. I want to see what I can accomplish for this body. I want to know what I can do and get a little stronger, you know? So that gives me a very different incentive to actually do it and to not have this feeling only last for a couple of weeks or less, which is what happens with most resolutions. So just, you know, in summary, an intention is something that comes from the inside out, a resolution from the outside in. And I think an intention is much gentler, much more self-respectful, and easier to maintain.
So the fact that I've got kale and beets sitting in my fridge since Sunday, I have an intention to make smoothies out of it, so I have a healthy breakfast. But you brought cookies to the studio today,
well,
so
it's a tradition.
You're helping me not, you know, be part of my New Year's Eve resolutions.
Yeah, we don't all have to be a part of your intentions.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to move on so I can get another cookie. You're listening to Talk Recovery. We come to you every Thursday. If you like what you're listening to, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com Talk Recovery Vancouver. And if you have any questions or you're going to hear something want to talk about on the phones with us, you can call us at 604-684-7561, because Candace is going to be on the show talking about a lot of different subjects. And I'm going to pass the microphone over to my co-host Frances Stone, who's going to get the interview started.
Awesome. Thank you. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Frances.
Welcome back to Talk Recovery.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you. Just for anybody that doesn't know, Candace was actually our first show ever, and that's very exciting. First guest on our first show, so that's really, really cool. And now we're in our second season, so exciting. And we're officially, gone from pilot status to a real radio show. So yay us. Yes, very exciting.
Woo-hoo. Wow, good for you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about you and tell our listeners who you are and how you know what you know. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about your own personal story and the book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself?
Okay. Well, I'm a recovering addict, and I've been clean and sober for 27 years now. And if anybody had ever told me that I would be clean and sober for 27 years or even at all, I would have thought they were nuts, but, you know, one day at a time, and here it is. My addiction really started when I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is a quite a debilitating illness. It's an inflammatory bowel disease that has no apparent cure. So I was diagnosed in 1973, and that was at a time when the doctors really didn't know what to do for me. They had no idea. It was a fairly new illness, and so they misdiagnosed me for a year and put me on the wrong meds, which was not helpful at all. Mm-hmm. But they also gave me a lot of addictive medication that, you know, if you, when I look at this, to their, you know, in their defense, I know that addiction was not on the radar at that point. It is today, and doctors are still prescribing this kind of medication, which angers me a lot. But at that point, I don't think they knew what they were doing to me at all. Mm-hmm. And so they were giving me Valium and codeine and Demerol, which would be, like today's OxyContin, that kind of a drug. And they were giving me as much as I wanted, as often as I wanted, and telling me to use it. So, you know, good girl that I was, and feeling really uncomfortable in my body, I used them for a long time and got very addicted. And rediscovered pot, which hadn't been a problem for me before. I was a social pot user. Mm-hmm. But at that point, it became a real problem. So I became addicted to all of those things. And all of them are depressants in the system. Anybody's body would get addicted to these drugs. Mm-hmm. And I became very, very depressed to the point where I was suicidal. And had to get some help with that, or actually made a choice to get some help with that. Because what I know to be true today is that most people who feel suicidal don't really want to die. Most people don't want to live the way they've been living, but they don't know what else to do. So please reach out if you're feeling like that. Please reach out for some help. There is help here for you.
And so how did you come to think of writing the book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself?
Well, about 3 years into my recovery, I started working in the Downtown East Side, and I was down there for about 16 years working at Watari, which is an amazing outpatient alcohol and drug service. And I was working mostly with the addicts and the alcoholics down there, but I started getting phone calls from the loved ones of these clients I was working with, or sometimes not the clients, sometimes just loved ones of addicts and alcoholics. And so they started to come to see me. And at first I didn't know how to help them. I'd never had any training. I didn't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. Even being a loved one myself, I didn't know what to do. But as I heard their stories and they, you know, I started to hear some patterns, like, you know, they were supporting financially the addicts. They were giving them money. They were allowing them to live in their homes and letting them punch holes in the walls and being obnoxious and abusive and doing those kinds of things. And I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. Mm-hmm. There's another way. And so I was doing some counseling with the loved ones for a while and excuse me, realized that I had some things to share and decided to write a book, and that was that.
And here we are.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And your book has helped so many people, and that's really awesome.
Thank you.
Okay, now that's for you. Now I just want to take a little minute to get back to the Valentine's Day thing. Mm. So for me, I've just gone through a breakup. So got through Christmas, got through New Year's, and now, okay, here's Valentine's Day. Great. Mm. What do you call that?
Well, I call that the most obnoxious trilogy ever known to humankind.
I agree.
Mean, first you have Christmas that you have to get through, especially if you're clean and sober or you know, in recovery or even not in recovery or codependent or having any kind of relationship issues. You have to get through Christmas, and then there's New Year's Eve, which, unless you know something like what Giuseppe was just talking about, you don't know what to do with yourself on New Year's Eve, and if you don't have anything to do, then you're a nobody, you're a loser. So you gotta go through that, and then,
thanks, Candace.
You know, like a month later, you get Valentine's Day, where the underlying belief is that you're nobody till somebody loves you. And I don't know who wrote that song, but they should be strung up. Hmm. Because, you know, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That's just ridiculous.
That's pretty much the codependent, like, mantra, though, isn't it, really?
It is, but it's everybody's mantra. I think in society we really teach people that. We really believe that if we don't have a significant other in our lives, mm-hmm. aside from ourselves, if we don't have a significant other, then there's something wrong with what's going on here. And I take exception to that now.
So do I.
Yeah.
So do I.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
So what is the fantasy around Valentine's Day? Because even when I've been in relationships on Valentine's Day, I'm disappointed if I'm in a relationship, and I'm disappointed if I'm not in a relationship. So what is the fantasy there?
I think the fantasy has to do with having this absolutely perfect relationship. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it starts with having a perfect somebody who has lots of hair on his head, who has no cellulite on her hips, like I do, you know. I mean, who is absolutely perfect, and you gaze into each other's eyes, and you're the best thing that ever happened to him, and he's the best thing that ever happened to you, and everything is so wonderful, and he brings you diamonds, and he brings you chocolates, and you know, it's that kind mm-hmm. of thing that just never really happens, or if it does, it doesn't usually last very long.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
What need does that serve? I mean, like, we all do things because they serve our needs, like, regardless, right? So what need do you think that serves?
I think it helps us feel special.
Mm.
You know, we're on a planet that's populated with billions of people, and we're basically all the same,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And there's a saying in 12-step programs, I don't know, help me out here, because I don't know if I've got it backwards, but I think it says, you're unique, but you're not special. Is that the way it goes?
I don't know.
You're unique, but you're not special. Because you're not special because everybody is exactly the same way that we are. We're all the same. But there is nobody quite like me, and there's nobody quite like you. So I'm unique, and you're unique, but we're not really special. And we're bombarded with messages that tell us that we should be special.
I always thought I was special.
you're unique like everybody else.
You're unique like everybody else. But, you know, they talk, again, in 12-step programs, they talk about terminal uniqueness. And
yes.
If you need to be that special, if you need to be that unique, it could kill you.
Or at least ruin a lot of relationships, for sure.
Yeah, get you in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to ask a little bit, you know, a little bit on topic, a little bit off topic, but for people that are going through a breakup, or say they're in the no contact phase of the ending of the relationship, or if they have a partner that's in recovery that they can't talk to or whatever, that's not really imposed no contact. Well, I guess maybe it would be. But what is no contact, and when is it necessary?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by no contact. Are you saying that there's some kind of a rule of no contact? Can
well,
you
a lot
say
of people,
more about that?
I think it's sort of like a thing in codependency. It's quite common, codependency or in relationships where boundaries have been crossed,
okay.
or whatever. And so then and even sometimes I wonder if it's a way of avoiding conflict. Mm-hmm. And so somebody will say, like, you know, that's it. Like, you can't talk to me anymore and that sort of thing. And
mm-hmm.
we're not going to talk and no contact and whatever. It's kind of a common practice, actually.
Yeah.
In recovery.
I guess I haven't heard of it quite like that, labeled no contact. But it makes sense to me. I think what we really need to do is look at self-respect. And if there's somebody that's being abusive with you in any kind of way, mm-hmm. and you don't want contact with that person, you need to have that boundary.
Yeah, and it's a personal choice for sure.
Yeah.
And I think in that situation, it'd probably be healthy for both people as well. So you wrote an article for Huffington Post, and it was from Fantasy to Reality on Valentine's Day, Loving Yourself with Healthy Self-Care. And it's not even out yet. It'll mm-hmm. be out closer to Valentine's Day. But I just wanted to touch on one point that you made in the article, which is planning in advance for the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this because I was thinking about Valentine's Day because of this interview. Other than that, I sort of was denying that it existed. And I could see myself not doing that, like not planning in advance and like trying to ignore that it's going to come up and then ignore that it's that day and then that sort of thing, right? So so what do you suggest in terms of healthy self-care for planning in advance?
Well, I think we need to look at how we can best take care of ourselves on that day and be our own best partner that day, and maybe, you know, and I think every day. I think if we can, when we finally learn to be our own best friend and our own best partner, we've got the best person hanging out with us 24/7, and it's an amazing feeling that I did not always have, but I have now, and it's not negotiable in my life at all. It just, you know, it isn't going to be any other way. But I think that you can be really healthy and be in a relationship. I think you can be really unhealthy and be in a relationship. But for me, I would want to be really healthy in a relationship. And I'd want somebody else, the person I'm in relationship with, to be taking care of himself, too, to be looking after himself. So, you know, I think on that day especially, although it can happen at other times, too, do you maybe want to buy yourself some flowers? Or do you maybe want to buy yourself a cookie? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not a whole box of chocolates. Maybe for you that's not a good idea, but maybe a cookie would be, you know. How do you want to take care of yourself? Do you want to plan ahead and maybe you and your best friend go and see a movie, or your partner? If you're in a relationship, maybe you and your partner do something and you plan for that to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the other things that you can do are looking at ways to give back to the community. And that helps people feel so much less alone. And, you know, there are a couple of examples that I use with people. One of them is that there are hospitals that have babies that, you know, have been abandoned, that have nobody there with them, and they need to be hugged. Mm-hmm. And if you're a person who loves babies, go and hug some babies. You know, awesome. Wonderful thing to do. If you love animals, go to the shelter, go play with some of the dogs and cats, and just, you know, have a good time yourself and give back.
Just sort of get over it. Well, like, in a way, like, just take the importance off the holiday, importance off having a partner, like, that sort of stuff.
Because you're really nobody until you love yourself.
Yeah.
It's not until somebody else loves you. It's until you really care enough about yourself and respect yourself enough to do what's right for you.
That's awesome. And on that note, we're going to hold that thought, and Darren's going to take us to our first song. And thank you very much, Candace.
So we're back on Talk Recovery, you know, Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5. FM. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We're sitting with Candace Plattor, and we're talking about Valentine's Day, the holidays, the occasions. I love Candace because I know she's got some of the same ways of thinking as we do in the booth, and sometimes it's like there's a set social expectation. How you're supposed to feel, and I appreciate the resolution versus intention theory there. It makes sense. I know exactly what you're talking about. And when I'm sitting on the couch New Year's Eve, knowing that there's a really good, amazing party going on, it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm feeling sorry for myself, mm-hmm. or that I got nobody to kiss at midnight, and the movie that I just watched, the romantic comedy or whatever, isn't my life. So I'm just going to sit here and suck my thumb on the couch. It's a matter of perspective for me. It's just another day. And I don't want to get into these controlled ways of thinking and feeling that are that I've lived by. You know, how I'm supposed to feel, how I'm supposed to think, how I'm supposed to feel about myself, that I'm worthy only when I'm in a relationship. I think it's useless ways of feeling. And, you know what though, but, you know, it's important to know that there's a desire for those people that are unhealthy, and I'll say unhealthy people, I won't just label addicts, just people mm-hmm. that aren't of a healthy state of mind, that are looking for an excuse, mm-hmm. that are looking for a reason to feel that way, mm-hmm. you know? And so, I mean, from that foundation, if you find yourself sometimes like, you know, on a certain occasion making you feel a certain way, like, what excuse are you looking for? And that being said, like, do you want to help reframe that? Because, I mean, there's books, there's people, there's us, there's experiences of people that have reframed that thinking and that refuse to allow themselves to feel that way anymore. Yeah. And that's what we're talking about today. And you have a workshop coming up on the 17th. Do you want to talk about that? It's kind of focused around this, isn't it?
Because it's everything's sort of connected. It's like I really think the knee bone's connected to the thigh bone, especially in all of addiction and recovery. But I'm just going to comment on what you were saying before, because it's really about deciding for ourselves what we're going to buy into and what we're not going to buy into. And we are definitely told over and over in so many different ways what to buy into. We have choices, and I think we need to make them. We need to look inside, see who we are, see what we believe, and make those choices.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, holidays and such. I mean, I got well through workshops, you know, as part of a whole combination of things. You know what I mean? Recovery. But what is recovery when people are talking? Like, what is recovery? Go to a meeting? That's 1 hour. You know what I mean? It's a meeting. It's listening to other people. Like, these workshop ideas. I mean, I've sat in a ton of rooms with hundreds of people listening to people's experiences, professional theories, ideas, proven statistics. You know what I mean? All of these things that have all helped to reframe this thinking, to gain a broader perspective. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, to help with what your workshop is about, you know, who's there? Who do you want there? What's the theme?
Okay. Well, what we're doing is we're developing a series of workshops for loved ones, but also for the counselors and therapists and psychology students as well, healers of any kind, who are working in some capacity with loved ones because, you know, there are so many people out there who are the loved ones of people with addiction of any kind across the board. And for every one addict, every one person who's addicted, generally, there are about a dozen or more people who are affected by that person's addiction. And, you know, I believe that if we go out on the street and we see people walking up and down the street, even though it isn't tattooed on our foreheads, I'm the loved one of an addict, probably 99.9% of the people on the street are loved ones of addicts. And that includes addicts.
Mm-hmm.
Addicts, and when I say addicts, I mean alcoholics, whatever. Because many of us grew up in alcoholic homes or addicted homes, or we've been in relationships with people that we love who are addicted, whatever. So, but it affects so many, many people. And what happens often from a professional standpoint, what happens is that people come in for counseling with a certain presenting issue that they have, you know, I'm anxious or I'm depressed or I'm whatever, and they're not really talking about being the loved one of somebody with an addiction. Sometimes it's because they don't recognize that they are, but sometimes it's because they feel a lot of shame around this. They feel a lot of guilt that maybe they've caused it, which they haven't, because addicts make their own choices. But counselors and therapists, healers are seeing in their offices loved ones all the time and sometimes are not aware of it. We need to be training people about how to work with loved ones in an effective way so that they can actually make some changes that work and the people that they love who are addicted can get well.
Mm. Because so, I think we'd hope that there's just this, you know, one kind of framed solution on how to deal with a loved one who's addicted.
Yeah.
Like, it's just true for no matter who you're talking about, no matter what culture or family dynamic or whatever you're coming from. That would be awesome. Like, here's the one book that's going to tell you, you know, whoever's picks it up to read exactly what they need to do.
Well, but when you're, mine's kind of like that, but
well, but if you hit the right points,
yeah,
you know, because the fact of the matter is it's so difficult until you hear exactly what that individual's walls and barriers are and ignorances that are happening. You know, there is no one solution.
Mm. I think my book talks about it in more of a general kind of way. In ways that probably do positively affect most people who read it. But I really agree with you that, you know, when you're in somebody's office as a professional, you need to get further in. You need to go deeper and find out where this all started. How is this different for you than it is for somebody else? Because my boundaries may be different than your boundaries. You're you, I'm me, you know. And most people who are loved ones are codependent. And, of course, that's a buzzword that basically means that you put other people's needs ahead of your own on a pretty consistent basis. And most loved ones do that. Most loved ones of addicts are addicted to the addict's addiction. So they've got their own addiction that they need to overcome. And they're saying yes when they know they need to be saying no. And we need therapists, counselors, healers, all across the board who know how to help loved ones do that so that everybody in the system can get well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a family problem. It's a family solution.
Absolutely. So my workshop is about training the counselors. You know, I'll be probably telling people things they already know, but I'll also be teaching them some new things, and we'll be looking at, you know, if you're a counselor yourself, are you also a loved one? And so what kinds of things are getting triggered for you as I talk about stuff, you know?
And that's so important to have that profession, you know, being those that are in workshops as students, as people with
doing
an open
mind.
Doing
their inner work.
You know, because you don't want to learn the hard way where you're in a situation and somebody's talking about some unresolved issues of yourself. You're not going to be able to give the right advice.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I love the fact that, you know, these people in these positions, you know, need to be present for these workshops and you know, always working on themselves. It's one of the, you know, and that's what is some of the blocks to those loved ones going through the stuff is that they haven't worked through their own stuff in order to know with integrity how to handle a very difficult situation.
Yeah. And it's true that, you know, counselors, therapists, we need to be doing our inner work on a consistent basis. And one of my bugaboos is when we don't, people who don't and who are trying to help others, because they can be dangerous.
Yeah.
With clients, and we need to not have that happen. And so an example of this could be that if I'm not doing my own inner work, if I don't have my own counselor, I think everybody needs a counselor, especially counselors. If I don't have my own, and I'm not doing my own work, and you come in as a client and you are really angry. You're really angry. You might not even be angry with me, but you're angry and you're swearing and you're riled up about something. And I'm scared of anger and I haven't worked through that. How am I going to help you in any kind of healthy way? And if I can't do that, then I might be dangerous to you. I might tell you something like, well, you know, it doesn't really do any good to get angry. Don't get angry.
Yeah.
That would be horrible to say to you, right?
Or it looks like we're almost at a time here. So
let's leave this till next session.
So
what do you do with the family members? So there's Al-Anon, there's Nar-Anon. You know, I've always thought to myself, Al-Anon and Nar-Anon should be five times the size of AA and NA and CA because everyone's got parents and everyone's got wives and all that. Yeah. So, and they're not. They're substantially smaller. And then you've got in Vancouver, you've got From Grief to Action. They help with Parents Forever. I mean, there's lots of groups out there. There really is lots of groups out there. I mean, if you go on the internet, there's plenty if you Google it. And then there's, you know, your counselors. So what do you do with parents? For example, we work at Last Door, and there's parents that call, and, you know, I have my love son, and he's doing heroin, and he's, you know, 45 years old living in my basement. And you're that person's sister or that person's brother. And, you know, the parents aren't doing anything for themselves, because we always say, go to Nar-Anon, go to Al-Anon, go somewhere. Because if you don't get well, your son's never going to get well, potentially. So what do you do? Like, what do you do if you're a family member of someone that you know has a sick child or a sick husband, and they're just, you know, paying the bills and kind of, you know, in denial
and
of the whole thing.
And staying addicted to the addict's addiction.
What do you do? How do you get them motivated to actually get some help for themselves?
Well, whoever it is that calls me, if it's the daughter, for example, in your example, calling me, that's the person I work with. Okay. I don't work with the heroin addict. Okay. I work with the person who calls me. And we talk and we start looking at some things, and then hopefully the parents will come in as well. We'll be looking at what kind of boundaries need to be set, because the thing that a lot of loved ones don't quite understand is that enabling an addict is not a loving act. It's never a loving act. It's not good for the addict. Mm-hmm. It's not self-respectful for the person doing it, and it's not healthy for the addict to continue to have everything paid for. That's what an enabling behavior is something like giving an addict money. It keeps the addiction going, mm-hmm. right? So we need to look at whose needs are really being met here, and often it's the needs of the loved one that's being met, and so we need to be changing that. The loved ones are not to blame for the addiction ever. The loved one didn't cause the addiction. I don't think the loved one ever causes the addiction, but the loved ones contribute to it continuing. And I believe, actually, I know this is provocative, but I believe that we can stop the war on drugs. I think we can stop it, but I think we have to stop the enabling that goes along with it first. Mm-hmm. If we can stop the enabling, and the addicts can say to themselves, oh, okay, life is hard as an addict. I'm not being cushioned. I'm not being rescued. Uh-oh.
It's interesting you say that, because I was just talking to someone the other day, and he's the child, and what did you use? Oh, I just ended up using oxys yesterday, and it's like, oh, where'd you get them? Oh, my mom got them for me.
Right.
Because right. I was going to hold my breath and turn blue if she didn't get him for me.
That's
that
right.
kind of attitude.
That's right.
I mean, Darren, you've crossed paths with me. What do you do? I mean, the mom's not the bad person.
Well, it's like, and that's where, like you said, the war on drugs just gets completely lost, where we're not saying the right thing. We're not asking the right questions. So let's go back to policies and laws and do it there. Because the fact of the matter is when people call, the first wrong question that always comes out, I'll say wrong, is how do I get my so-and-so yep. to stop using?
Right.
And it's just like, what all of a sudden, did you just think you were called God? like, what do you think a person on the other end of the line, no matter how many years professional counselor therapy or an addict themselves can help in that situation? See, that cannot be the problem, like that I can't get this person to stop. That is a reality. You cannot make anybody stop.
Exactly.
You cannot make anybody change. Mm-hmm. You can
Except
or cannot
yourself.
Be an influence to provide a better opportunity. That's it.
Yes.
The families are those that if they're the first point of contact, then they're the first point of the opportunity.
Yes.
And then when you realize that, that can come in many forms. Maybe paying for somebody, for their kid's treatment or their family member's treatment. Maybe kicking them out of the house. Mm-hmm. Like, who knows? It's all that family and their situation. Because you know what? Like, I mean, there's realities where it's just like, well, this person might need to be sheltered and given alcohol until brought to detox, or they might die in your home. Like, you know what I mean? And so if the enabling thing is to not, you know, just not give them money or give them drugs, like sometimes that gets miscommunicated, you know? And sometimes it's like, what are we making this decision for? What's the end result here? You know what I mean? When we're talking about somebody being addicted and the loved ones participating somehow in that, the next course of action is going to be temporary, isn't it?
It usually will, yeah.
Right? Like yeah. until the next thing and the next temporary yeah. thing and then the next temporary
but
temporary
they
thing.
Need to be working with somebody like myself, somebody who's skilled in this, who can help them see whether they need to give them alcohol for a little while until they get into detox.
Yeah.
And how many times is the addict going to say, I'll go to detox, I promise,
yeah.
and not do that? But I think, you know, for me, the message that loved ones need to give their addicted loved ones is we love you so much. You know, we love you. And we understand now that we've been enabling you and that that's not helpful. So we are going to stop enabling you. We're going to not support you anymore if you choose active addiction. While you're in active addiction, you will not be supported by us.
Yeah.
When you choose active recovery, let us know, because we'll be there for you. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to keep watching you shoot yourself in the foot, because it's too hard for us and it's not helping you.
Right. So, I mean, we use the word enabling, you know, quite a bit when we talk about loved ones and codependency and whatnot. And, you know, the typical, stereotypical position is, you know, giving money or, you know, looking past the behavior, allowing it to happen and that sort of thing. So that makes me think, like, cause that's not every family. Like, there's other people, you know, in addiction that come from a very detached, kind of careless, indifferent family. Now, so is that also a form of enabling where a family is not showing love or reminding that they care about that person? Is by not caring about someone and showing kind of a harshness, is that enabling them to use?
I guess you could call it enabling. I would call it neglect more than that.
Okay.
But,
is a form of?
I think so. And in fact, I went through that because that was the family that I came from. Right. You know, where I was in treatment and we had a family day and nobody from my family would come because it wasn't going to be quote unquote pleasant. So nobody came. And I was like the only person in the treatment center that had no family there, which was very difficult to deal with. But, you know, I mean, from a spiritual perspective, it didn't kill me. It made me stronger, but it was very hard at the time. I see that as being a form of neglect and a form of abuse emotionally. As opposed to enabling, where you're, I see enabling as a rescuing, as always cushioning, you know, always having that mat underneath them that's going to catch them, that net.
Mm-hmm. So for the addict in trouble, then, if that's the family that's coming to visit versus the other person like yourself across the room whose family isn't coming to visit, they're still in a problematic situation.
It's equally as unhealthy.
Right.
Yeah.
So that, yeah. And then I just wanted to make that point, because then it there is no set dynamic that dictates whether or not you can or cannot get well.
That's right.
And that's what we want to also remember.
And that's what we were talking about before, about how your boundaries could be different from my boundaries if you love somebody who's an addict.
That's Candace Platter, everyone. Finally, like, where can we get your book? How can we find out? Where are we going for the conference?
You can get information about that on my website. My website is CandacePlatter.com. And you can email me if you're interested in the conference. If you don't find the information or you just want to have more information, I'm at Candace@CandacePlatter.com. Could I spell that? Do I have time to spell
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Sure. Because my name is often misspelled. So it's CandacePlatter. PLATTOR. So it's Candace@CandacePlatter.com. Just email me and I'll be happy to tell you about the conference. It's coming up on January 17th, so it's very soon and it is filling up. So if you want to come, get in touch with me right away. We'd love to have you there. We want as many people as possible to hear about these tools and these information, you know, the information. So my book is Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. You can find information about that on my website as well. And it's now out in as an audiobook. And I'm the one reading it, so as Frances was saying before, she loves to have somebody read to you. I will read to you. And the book is now in its second edition, its second printing, and so it now has a chapter about my story of recovery and of addiction and recovery, and it didn't have that before.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Because it's such a great story. Candace Platter, thank you for coming in. Our first guest, always great to see you. Coming back and we'll be having many more interviews and anytime, you know, listening to our shows on SoundCloud, you know, if you hear a book or a person, you know, you can contact us at the studio here at Talk Recovery.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you very much, Candace, for being on our show and,